Hey, welcome into the garage. Big Jim's Garage here. Subscribe at iTunes as well. You can follow me locally here at WCSX in Detroit. Stephanie Brindley in studio, senior analyst, IHS Market.
Yes.
I got it right this time.
You did. Yay.
I had to do some research on that. Well, I always have to do research when you come in because you know a lot more about cars than I do.
I don't know.
Yeah, you do.
I know stuff.
Yeah, you do. See, I'm one of those guys. I'm the guy who sits on the third baseline and watches the Tigers game and then tells everything that's going on while I'm sitting next to a sportscaster going, shut up. But it was interesting to me. First thing I wanted to talk to you about was New York. What was your takeaway from the show?
You know, it was really – one of the things that I thought was interesting about this New York show is that it was a lot more near-term production-oriented. And that a lot of the vehicles that were shown were going on sale. There were a handful of concepts, but for the most part, it was stuff that's going on sale in the next couple of months at the end of this year.
Why do you think that is?
Because while we talk about electric vehicles and we talk about autonomous self-driving vehicles as sort of the space of the future and mobility and ride hailing, that is the space of the future.
Right.
We do still have cars to sell for quite a long time. And, I mean, IHS Markit's forecast right now for autonomous vehicles is, wrap your head around this, in 2040, we expect about 25% of global sales to be autonomous vehicles. That means 75% will still be normally driven globally.
Right, right.
I mean, so it's a big number.
But still.
But what that says is that for a lot of years, you still need to have vehicles that people will be driving. You know, autonomous stuff will play in different areas more so than others, but we still need these traditionally driven vehicles. We'll still need to continue to be more fuel efficient. We still need to continue to add more technology, and we still need to sell vehicles between now and when all of the major shifts happen. So
I was thinking about something too that, you know, there's so much talk about brick and mortar stores, not so much with cars, you know, and there is some, you talk mm-hmm. about what the folks at Tesla are doing. And you hear even Ford, some of them talk about buying a car online, ordering a car, brand loyalty. When we see the end of places like Toys R Us and a lot of the brick and mortar right. stores and everyone points at Amazon, as a culture, are we becoming less loyal to brands? Because automotive, my dad was the guy who bought the GM every 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And he even had the same sales guy. I mean, he went and got his car every 3 years. That's just what he did.
Yeah, there's a shift in brand loyalty, and it's somewhat generational, but there's definitely more of an interest in experiencing different brands and trying different brands, particularly, you know, your first couple of times out. Right. Definitely that's an issue. Overall, I'm not sure it's related so much to the dealership experience as it is partly to the level of choice. I mean, if we think about going back to what your dad did, at that point, if we go back, you know, GM at one point had 50% of the market.
Exactly.
It has 17% of the market and, you know, and is gaining a little bit of ground there. But you have so many more options and so much more choice. If I remember right, we're about 340 nameplates available in the United States right now.
That's crazy.
That's a few cars to choose from.
So does that make like, you know, I used to always make fun of the Buick commercials after a while. The whole thing where that's not a Buick, you know, the old person looking out the window. And what kind of car is that? Yeah. Maybe consumers today, like with the X, the station, the little, I almost said station wagon. Verboten, but it's what it is.
Right.
So those cars now may be more readily acceptable to consumers because there isn't this hang up on that it's a Buick. They're just looking at it for what the vehicle is.
I think that's true. And Buick did a good job with that ad campaign for a while. And if
I
you
agree.
Notice in the last few weeks with the Buick Tour X and the Regal coming out and with the Enclave, they've shifted a little bit of the tone of that advertising. The ones that I've been seeing the last week or 2 weeks.
Right.
They still focus on the vehicle, and they still show somebody walking by and being surprised at how cool it looks, being surprised at how capable it seems to be. But the that's a Buick tends to take a little bit of a backseat to just that's a neat vehicle. And I think that's a natural logical progression for that ad campaign.
Well, we look at what's going on with FCA here. I mean, obviously here in Detroit, there's as where we're taping this, there's more of a connection because we drive by the headquarters every day and we see what goes on at the Jefferson plant and stuff. But I was thinking, like, what is going on with FCA? Because I understand all the stuff with Alfa Romeo, and we see that, and the Ram truck is a huge push.
Mm-hmm.
But if you told me, is there something I'm missing with Dodge and Chrysler? Because I don't know what they're doing.
FCA's problem right now, or one of the issues that we're seeing play out with Dodge and with Chrysler, is a sort of a smaller war chest for being able to develop new vehicles. And so FCA has to be a little bit more discriminating in where they put those investment dollars. Right now it's in Alpha and it's in Ram and it's in Jeep. So that's what we're seeing more of right now. Dodge and Chrysler are not getting as much attention at the moment.
Is Chrysler necessary at this point? I mean, the Pacifica, obviously, but beyond that, there's
It's a really interesting question. Yeah. I think that there's it's an interesting question. I think you could make a case for, unfortunately, you know, what is the brand offering? It's offering a car and a minivan right now.
Yeah.
So there needs to be a hard look at that, I think. When FCA and Chrysler combined and Sergio Marchionne took over, they developed a strategy around five or six brands and thought perhaps you could take somebody who came in and bought a Fiat 500 and then move them into a Dodge Avenger and then maybe move them into a Chrysler 300 and then maybe move them into minivan and move them amongst brands to get to the vehicle that suited the lifestyle better. I think it's more difficult to do that. I think the Fiat 500 as an entry to the other FCA brands wasn't successful.
No.
At all. And in doing so, you've got a full line of vehicles. And you go to a Fiat, Chrysler, Dodge, Ram, Jeep dealership.
Sure, absolutely.
You have everything.
Yeah.
But everything is under a different brand flavor and a different brand personality. And that makes it a little bit difficult from a sales standpoint. And it's interesting because Ram and Jeep and Alpha and Dodge have been really, really good at making sure they've clarified their personalities. When you get into a Jeep, you know it's a Jeep. And they do it really well. But how do you take a Jeep buyer who also wants a sedan in their driveway and move them over to the Challenger or to the Charger? It's not as easy of a transition as it is for Chevrolet. You know, if you're in a Chevrolet SUV and you're in a Chevrolet truck, moving them over to a Malibu, it's still the same family. It still looks and feels the same. I think that's been one of the issues with FCA and managing those brands.
Well, you mentioned Chevrolet. The one thing I do, we have Stephanie Brindley in studio, senior analyst for IHS Market. I saw last week at the press release, you know, about the refresh. I would assume it's just a mid-cycle refresh.
Just a mid-cycle.
Okay. For their sedans.
Mm-hmm.
Where are we with sedans right now? I mean, you hear it all the time that, you know, no one's buying sedans anymore. And it's true. You see the year-to-year numbers. Can you ever see a time we're going to go back to that? I mean, is it a cyclical thing? Or have we changed again as consumers to where we like CUVs, we like what they offer, I don't need that sedan anymore?
Partially it's cyclical. Partially, I have a hard time seeing sedans recover to 40, 50% of the market again, or passenger cars, we should be clear, because that includes wagons and whatnot.
Right.
But I do think we've got a permanent shift. I think the utility of utility vehicles is driving that. But at the same time, there are still people who want passenger cars. So while the market is dropping and it's not what it used to be, there's still some healthy volume there. I mean, you know, 2 million units were still passenger cars last year. That's nothing to shake a stick at.
Right.
You know, it's certainly higher than minivan sales, for example, and we keep, you know, investing in minivans, maybe at a different level. But I think that we still will have them, but it has shifted. So that 30-35% share of passenger cars in the market makes a little bit more sense.
And then you look at, like, even like as a consumer, when I look at Chevrolet, I go, all right, do you need the Impala and the Malibu?
That's, I think, a question that Chevrolet is looking at as well. And the answer may be no. They'll evolve it over time. But the Impala, as far as we know, will stick around for its current life cycle. So we'll still see the Impala for a few more years. But what's happened to the more poor Impala is it's not only being pushed by the attraction of utility vehicles, it's also a large sedan, which when you get into a vehicle that size, I think from a consumer's perspective, the question starts to become, why don't I just get a utility vehicle?
Yeah.
Because I feel like I can carry more. I feel like I've got that taller cargo space, which is more useful to me as a consumer. And whereas the Malibu is slightly smaller. So it's got the benefit of being a little bit easier to drive around town than a Traverse, right? So with the Impala, you've got the large footprint of the vehicle itself with less utility than something like a Traverse would give you. And I think those things in combination are really hitting the large sedan segment quite hard right now.
And we're seeing more and more. I mean, you see the CUVs. What was it? Nissan. The Rogue's their best-selling vehicle now.
Right.
I mean, and then you look at I've had a chance to drive both the Traverse and the Equinox, the new ones. They're fantastic vehicles.
Right.
And you look at what Ford's going to be doing here now. We had the, you know, we know what's coming, but we can't talk about it. That was the weirdest thing I've ever been to. It's like, yeah, we're going to show you these, but you can't say a word about it.
Right.
You're killing me, Smalls. I can't. What do you mean I can't say anything about it? You just showed me the car. You can't talk about it. Like,
yeah.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, that's like a soft opening for a restaurant that's going to open next year.
It is.
Yeah, you got to wait nine months before you can come back here.
Ford's under some pressure to discuss product.
And they did a good story with that. But I was thinking, like, what other ones we talk about? FCA with the Journey. That's got to go away eventually, right?
I mean, eventually.
Eventually, but they're still making money because it is. Yep. You and I were talking about Volkswagen. We've both had time with the Tiguan and the Atlas. I don't know if the Tiguan, do you consider that a CUV? Probably.
It is.
Do you really?
It gets put into that category. You know, one of the interesting things about the CUV category is it was always a marketing term to begin with.
Oh, seriously?
I mean, really, it was a way for people to understand for within product planning what you wanted that vehicle to be more than anything else. And we do use it externally. And we use it in advertising and use it in different things like that. But it didn't really – it only means what you bring to the word. So if you – have a preference for tall hatchbacks, you may look at a Tiguan and say it's a tall hatchback, or you may look at the Lexus UX that was introduced in New York and say it's a tall hatchback. If you are more interested in utility vehicles and that's the shape that you prefer, you may look at it and say, okay, no, it is a utility vehicle. So it's one of those amorphous words that doesn't by itself mean a lot of anything.
What did you think of the pickup truck from VW?
The Atlas, or the Atlas, I can't even pronounce the name.
There's somebody there that I'm convinced gets hammered and then comes up with names for Volkswagen. They do a couple shots of Jägermeister and then come up.
I was so curious about that name. I looked it up, and apparently it's a North American pine tree.
What?
So there you go.
Okay.
That's what the Google says.
I stand correct. Now, the photos look great.
Look terrific. It looked terrific in person. It was a really interesting product. I think that the Atlas SUV that they're basing it off of, or that they may base it off of, is finally the VW product that does align with what consumers really in the U.S. really want.
Okay.
They've been working to do that. They weren't as successful with the Passat. They got close. But the Atlas really hits that. And the face of the Atlas looks really well. It looks really good. And I think the iteration that translated to that pickup truck translated quite well. I think it did look really good. It is a unibody pickup truck, which means that on the road, if it gets on the road, it would compete more directly with the Honda Ridgeline than it would with the Chevrolet Colorado.
That was the Honda Ridgeline when it first came out. We did a review of that. That was my most viewed video of the year.
Nice.
It was interesting to me. It was immediate. People just wanted – they didn't understand the whole – the swing-out tailgate and the storage. Honda did a great job of creating a buzz with that. And I kind of get the feeling if Volkswagen sticks close to this, what they showed us in New York, that truck should sell like crazy.
Well, like crazy is relative, because Honda's volume with the Ridgeline is 30,000 to 40,000 units a year.
Right.
VW won't match Honda on that, and part of it is because Honda has a better dealer network. Honda has better recognition. There's a lot of brand issues that would pull back the VW sales, I would expect, compared with the Honda version. So we are talking about an interesting vehicle, but we are not talking about a high volume vehicle, which is why they would almost have to do this on the Atlas. This is a way for Volkswagen to get into the pickup market in the U.S. and probably the only one that makes the most sense given the current paradigm. It needs to be produced in North America, particularly helpful if it's produced in the United States.
You got to tell that story.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, you do.
That's about a tariff that's been around since the 50s. Pickup trucks built outside the United States are tariffed 25%. That makes them unsaleable in the United States because it makes them too expensive. I mean,
so
imagine a Ram with another 25% on the
price.
So
the Ranger is going to be built here then, right?
The Ranger is going to be built here.
But it's a platform that's been used overseas for
It's been used overseas and it's heavily adapted for U.S. use. The U.S. expectation for a truck of that size is notably different than the international adaptation. Internationally, the expectation for ride isn't quite as high. The expectation for technology isn't quite as high. And even though it's a pickup truck, and if you get into here, you get into a pickup truck versus a sedan, you feel like your pickup truck's rough and ready and ready to go. Well,
right.
An international pickup truck that's, you know, meant to deal with off-roading and South America and Africa and Middle East has a completely different mindset. So it takes a lot of work to adapt those international pickup truck platforms to build them in the United States, and Ford and Chevrolet and GMC have both done so. But with Volkswagen, they don't have a strong place to build. They have a midsize pickup truck that they sell in overseas called the Amarok. They don't have a production location in the United States that they can easily transfer to that platform. If they build this off of the Atlas platform, you've got a plant in Chattanooga, so you avoid the tariff on the truck. And you may have some capacity within that plant to add 30 or 40,000 units of a vehicle. It doesn't necessarily need to support the whole plant. It's a nice little add-on.
And it's interesting, too, how plant, even the technology, we talk so much about technology in cars, but technology in plants themselves, the ability to, like, a friend of mine, Gordon Rentschler, he was one of the first people to help set up, like, a line for Chrysler that could do multiple vehicles. Yeah. And that at the time was space age. People were like, are you crazy? And now, like you're talking about, I mean, you can do multiple vehicles on one line.
Yes, absolutely. And that has to keep happening because one of the reasons we have as much choice as we do and one of the reasons that the market can be profitable the way that it is making sure that you can build vehicles that share some sort of component, that share platform, that share powertrain. These things need to be fairly common in order to meet your sort of profitability targets. At the same time, giving consumers the choice that they actually are demanding.
Hey, looping back to small cars with Stephanie Brindley here, senior analyst at IHS Market. I got the teaser video from Ford about the Focus.
Yeah.
And then I was reading some of the thing where they're talking about that this sounds like, to me, the impression I get, we're not going to get this till what, October?
Yeah.
Okay. It seems to me like they're going away from being an entry-level car, that it will be more, I would assume, upper 20s, $30,000 range. So they're going to class these up. Is that kind of the trend, or is Ford just going to do what they're going to do?
It's going to be interesting. This is a space to watch, I think. I've just spent some time with Chevrolet talking about their mid-cycle updates to the Malibu and the Malibu and the Spark and the Cruze. And Chevrolet was looking at the where their vehicle falls onto the price ladder within that set, within each of its segments.
Yeah.
And they see theirs are a little bit higher. So they see some opportunity for capturing some of the lower end. If Ford, without giving up the upper end, because then Malibu gets a new RS Sport appearance package, you keep focus on the premier trim levels. So Chevrolet's not talking about going down market with it at all or going away from those top trims that people like, but adding and building at the lower end in a way that gives buyers some personality with the vehicle, that gives them the content that they want, that keeps the production, I'm sorry, the complexity of the plant down and captures some of that. Ford is, of course, they have said they're going to go and say, sedans and passenger cars aren't selling that well, so we're going to focus on the higher end.
Well, we were told at that event that 86% of their 86% of their portfolio in 2 years are going to be trucks and SUVs.
Right, and that's certainly what they've said, and it's an interesting approach. But at the same time, you leave the door open. One thing that passenger cars can do for an automaker is you do have a price point that some people will enter a brand through and enter the market through. There's anywhere between a $2,000 and $5,000 difference between the part for part, you know, trim level for trim level, between a sedan and an SUV. So there's still a cost differential in there. And that means that there's it's still an area where somebody doesn't necessarily, maybe not afford getting into the utility vehicle, but like a small utility vehicle isn't necessarily big enough to comfortably can handle what a Malibu can handle.
Right.
A Trax and a Malibu cannot handle the same set of things. But somebody, and there are people that are in that Malibu space or in that mid-size space that might not be able to do the walk up to the Traverse or the Equinox. And so there's some play in there. And once you get that sedan buyer in, that passenger car buyer in, you can work on keeping them.
But again, Ford, though, if they're doing what we anticipate with this, where, I mean, they're going to move this price point up significantly for the Focus. Where do you get into a Ford car then? Where do you get into the Ford brand?
Yeah, that's well, in some ways, you still do it with the Focus, but do it with a higher level of Focus.
Okay.
In maybe EcoSport, I think, is where they would like to see people come into the brand there. And it's just, it's two different strategies. And it's interesting to watch those two come together. I'm not sure that one is fundamentally right and one is fundamentally wrong. What happens is the one that's right for each company is the one that matches that company's resources.
Maybe it's me, and I have not driven the EcoSport yet. I have seen a lot of it, and I've looked at it, and I've seen other people driving it, and I've seen it on the road. It looks out of place. It looks flimsy. It looks cheap to me. It doesn't look like my expectation for the Ford brand. I was surprised when I saw it because I had a higher expectation, and now every time I see it, I'm like, meh.
Yeah, I have not had a chance to drive it as well either. So I'm in the same position as you on that. But yeah, it's a facelifted version of an international product. So it inherently wasn't yet fully designed for the U.S. market. the next generation hopefully will be a little bit better aligned. You saw Chevrolet do this with the Trax.
Yeah.
The very first Trax that we had for about 18 months before it took a
facelift. Oh, it was awful. It was awful.
It was not quite where we wanted it to be.
It was, in my opinion, that was a whip in the drive.
Yeah. It was a little rattly. It was a little buzzy.
Right.
And it didn't feel as solid as it needs to be. They quickly remedied that. They knew they were going to be able to quickly remedy that. And
it's
Ford
a good point.
Maybe
it is fun to drive now. Yeah.
It is fun to drive now. And, that's part of that evolution. I talked about the pickup truck versus international pickup truck versus what the expectations are for U.S. pickup truck. It's same thing with those small utility vehicles. The EcoSport is maybe a little bit shy of what American drivers really want.
But weren't the Ka was the right. Focus or the and then which one was
Fiesta? Ka was Fiesta. Related to Fiesta, but it wasn't
Kuga.
The Fiesta.
The Kuga was
is the
Escape. Yes,
the difference being that the Kuga Escape program was developed simultaneously for the U.S.
Oh, I didn't know
Europe.
That. Okay, because we were always most people were under the impression that they had actually same idea. They taken some over in Europe, it was successful, and they brought it over.
No. Those were developed together, and I think the Kuga might have hit the market a few months after the Escape even. But yeah, no, those were developed together. The example of the EcoSport was initially they've considered bringing that vehicle over to the United States several times, but hadn't really developed it for that purpose. And now I've decided to, with this facelift on it, to go ahead and make that move. Whereas Escape and Kuga, Escape was always intended to be a high-volume, important product for the United States. And that's true of the Chevrolet Trax as well. They initially did not plan to bring that here.
They know that. Because I know the Buick version sold like crazy.
Yes.
It's funny how that little Buick created more buzz than anything Buick had done.
It is. It's just, sometimes you are in the right place at the right time with the right product and you just grab hold of it when you can. Because as much effort as everybody puts into trying to figure this out, it's still a bit of art and science. And sometimes you knock one out of the park and sometimes you don't.
I call them pet rock cars because everyone goes, really? That's the one you want. Okay. All right.
Yeah, it is.
So one thing I can talk about at the Ford event that they brought up, I thought was really interesting when they talked about the Bronco. They were very singular in their focus that they're going after Jeep with this thing.
Yeah.
And that to me, I was sitting here going in my head like, all right, who has ever gone after Jeep directly recently?
No, they haven't.
Nobody. I mean, you kind of Jeep is such a strong brand. I'm sure Jeep, it when you do Q studies around the world, it's got to be in the top 100. It has to be. You say Jeep
brands,
anywhere
yeah.
in the world, people go, yep, I know exactly what it is.
Absolutely. There's instant recognition for that name for a whole host of reasons. But there's instant recognition for the Ford name as well.
And the Bronco.
So the Bronco name. So the name isn't so much the issue. It's interesting. I've seen, looking at Bronco, looking at Chevrolet having a product, another SUV in development as well. And
Laser.
Curious to see, how that evolves. You've seen Toyota put out a couple of concepts that were a little more aggressive. And as utility vehicles become the dominant type in there, you still have consumers that want something a little bit different, something a little bit special. And off-road is one way that utilities can do that. You do even have fast on-road utility vehicles in, say a 707 horsepower Trackhawk, right?
I had somebody blow by me in one of those Friday.
Yeah.
Laughed my ass off. The sound of it, it was on 75 or freeway here in Detroit and around Auburn Hills, and they went blown by me in the left-hand lane. And the noise it makes.
It's fantastic.
It is. You're just laughing going
fantastic.
Like, there's no good reason to have that, but God, it looks like fun.
It's fun. It's fun. An SUV cannot handle quite the same as a performance sedan or a performance car, but you can still get into those upper edges and play pretty nicely with some of the electronics you have. But the other space to do that is off-road rather than a track car. And as that space of the market gets more full, you need to find a hook. You need to figure out where are the margins, where are the underserved markets. Off-road may be part of it. The beauty of off-road and the beauty of performance utility vehicles is they can cast a halo for the rest of the brand.
It's true. And the Bronco, and they did, I remember this is the on the record part. They had very specific talk points too. They were bringing up things like, our customers don't go to Moab. It was very Jeep centric. They were pointing at them going, our customers like to go fishing and camping. And every photo was obviously going to show us the vehicle again.
Right.
But they did talk about how everything I noticed was revolved around, to your point, revolved around a family. Mm-hmm. It wasn't some dude in his jeans or some girl with her hair underneath the rocking her hat out, listening right. to, you know, got her Kenny Chesney cranked up. It was a family who just happened to have a vehicle that was fun to drive off road. If you wanted mm-hmm. to take a dirt trail to get somewhere, you could do it.
Yeah, and that's where it'll live. And like I said, as that market gets busier and more crowded, I think we're going to see a little bit more of that. The question is, how high is that space really at? You know, and how much do people buy more than they need because we've done it before, and we hit a recession and we pulled back? So there's an optimism about utility vehicles that does seem to relate to consumer confidence, at least relate to it if it's not causal. I'm not saying that. But, you know, when you feel optimistic and you look at something like the way that Ford is presenting the Bronco, and you look at the things that the Wrangler and Wrangler Unlimited can do, I mean, who doesn't want to be the person that's going to go do all that, at least in your head?
Right.
I mean, you want to be able to do that. I want to go hiking. I want to go do all this stuff. I might not, but I want to be able to think that I can. And it really relates to a mood of optimism. When, you know, more broadly, we're not feeling as optimistic, then we start getting more practical and we start thinking about whether or not we can move the family. We start thinking about fuel economy. We start thinking about all these things in different ways. Right now, we're in a fairly optimistic space.
My wife always, Kathy, puts a great point. We'll go to dinner somewhere, or we're out at the mall or shopping or something, and she'll see some guy pull up in a CJ and it's spotless. And she's like, why are you driving that car? Come on, man. If you got one of those, take it.
I should have a little bit of dirt on it.
I had the 4Runner, and we took it up to Flint, went to the ORV place. You got to go beat the hell out of those things. It's what they're built for.
It is. And, you know, just, we'll see how many people really want it. I mean, even with the Jeep Wrangler and the Wrangler Unlimited, you know, it's a much higher off-road use, but it's still not 100%, as you've seen, as you point out to the one that went to the mall.
Yeah.
Some of its image, for sure.
So the speaking of image, Alpha seems to be really, I mean, I know obviously that they're invested in marketing it, but the Silvio, the Stelvio, I keep calling it Silvio. I'm a big Sopranos fan. The Stelvio, it was surprising to me on the British Top Gear. They actually did an SUV comparison with three of them, and Matt LeBlanc was driving that.
Okay.
And you're just waiting for the hammer to drop, right? You're waiting for them to start busting balls on it. It was a tank.
It drives well. I have had the opportunity to drive that car, and I do like it quite a bit. You know, Alpha coming back has been something I've been slightly skeptical of. We have 340 or so makes and or models and you know, 45 makes. How many more do we need, right? But having said that, the Stelvio does seem to be taking off pretty well. It's in the right space. It's the right size. It does look a little bit different than some of the utility vehicles that are out there.
I mean, talk about tall hatchback, though. Yeah, yeah.
It's definitely a tall hatchback. But in this market, it's not really a super surprise that Stelvio is doing better than Giulia. But the question for Alpha will be how long. You know, it's going to take a long time to really rebuild the brand. And when the next products are coming. So Alpha shouldn't be looked at as a 2 or 3 year project. It's still, in spite of the fact that we've been working on it for 8 years, it's still another 10 year project.
And I saw that Giulia, now they're talking about how they're going to kind of up them up a little more horsepower. There's some, you know, new packages coming like that. That doesn't, to me, extend the brand. That just dresses it up a little bit.
It does, but what you do for an automaker and for a consumer, I mentioned consumers like choice. Consumers like to feel like there's something a little bit special about theirs. Their Stelvio and their Giulia isn't the same one that the guy up the street has, or 5 Series, or fill in the blank. One way to do that is these blackout packages that we're seeing a lot of. Give it a little bit more horsepower.
Yeah.
You know, talking about technology, we've come a long way in manufacturing of technology, so we can have, you know, contrast striping or stitching in seats, and you can have different colors in the seats. And some of these things are relatively inexpensive for an automaker to do, especially if it's, say, a leather color that's in the system someplace else. And yet create something special that a consumer is attracted to and will spend a little bit more money for. And it doesn't necessarily mean that the top model gets more expensive. Sometimes it's just about how you bundle the mid-range. You bundle these packages together in a way that the consumer is happier about it, but you've also put things together that are easier to build, use the parts that you want to have built, and you can affect the profitability of that particular car as it goes off the lot. And you can find a real sweet spot. Both for the consumer and the automaker.
Like that. The Chinese company that bought 8% of FCA, that's mm-hmm. right? Geely, right?
Geely.
Why wasn't that a bigger story? Maybe in
depends on where you're looking.
Well, I mean, like you're in the industry, so maybe internally it was. But
we watched it pretty closely.
Outside, it didn't seem like, I'm like, they just bought almost 10% of FCA, and it just kind of
was it eight or was it seven? The number has escaped
so,
me.
So yeah,
it's not a controlling stake. It's a significant stake, but it's not a controlling stake, and we're kind of waiting to see how that comes together. It's certainly a development. And Geely, though, has been really aggressive in what they're buying and really aggressive in trying to expand. On that, there's going to be a bit of wait and see.
So does this motivate maybe the Volkswagen or the Nissan or one of them to go after parts of FCA? FCA now seems to me like, again, from the outside looking in, it feels like a company that's fragmented to be this things they want to hold on to, and maybe they'll give up certain things.
I've had this conversation.
We have
talked about it before. I still think that with FCA, the difficulty in splitting it out and another automaker taking it on is the component issue. I mean, the powertrain, the e-torque powertrain that is going to go into the Ram 1500 and go into the Jeep Wrangler, it also has to go into, you'll see it in Dodge products.
Right.
You'll see it in other places, and you'll see some version of that used for Alphas and Maseratis. When you start splitting those up, your cost for those systems goes much higher, and it's difficult to find as much value. And Nissan and Volkswagen, as examples, already have pretty robust production facilities. Picking up a plant that doesn't have a system that correlates with any system that they use, doesn't have a platform that correlates with any platform that they have, the process of merging those two things takes a decade or so.
We used to call that fratricide in the service. That's like, you know, dropping two bombs on the same target.
Yeah, it is.
But then Geely, though, that this would give them a footprint in North America that they seem to want.
Geely is already, they own Volvo. So Volvo's plant is opening next year.
So
that's certainly a thing. I mean, don't kid yourselves. There are Chinese automakers with ambitions to sell in the United States. It's going to happen eventually.
Right.
Precisely when, we'll kind of have to wait and see. And again, I still look at the fact that we've got all of these cars and all of these makes right now. It's difficult to slice this pie even smaller than it is. Exactly when it'll happen is really open to question.
So I noticed you did not bring a Corvette ZR1 to the station to record this podcast today.
No, I didn't.
You had some seat time, though.
Seat time I did. Went for a ride with Tommy Milner driving.
So comparative.
I learned I don't know how to brake.
Oh, is that what it is?
No, it's, you know, it was really interesting riding along with Tommy and a nice opportunity for me. But I have been on tracks and I can have fun and enjoy myself. But I'm not, you know, as good as a race car driver. Come on.
Oh, well, those
right?
guys.
So
yeah.
Watching him drive and just fly into the corners and hard on the brakes, I'm like, you know, that's when I am on the track. I think that's the thing that I trust the least. I won't come in as hot as I should because I'm not willing to brake as hard as he did.
Oh, I'm with you. Anytime,
so,
every
like,
time
that's
we talk.
That's what I need to learn how to do better.
Right.
And
these,
on a track.
And they know. I mean, but was it startling to drive that car? Because it looks unbelievably fast.
I was riding.
But that makes it even worse when you're in the passenger seat.
It was amazing what it could do. And it's fast, and he's incredibly competent, and you still feel good. It's a nice piece of machinery for sure.
That's their halo for this year.
Yes.
And then the mid-engine next year.
So we hear.
So we've seen enough photos of the thing.
I know.
Unless somebody's bored and made like the greatest prank ever and drives around the middle part, that'd be a horrible prank.
That would be funny.
Wouldn't that be funny if you just took some kit car and made it into and just put some manufacturer plates on it and drove around? With their,
but it's interesting that, you know, we talk about preference for utility vehicles. Sports cars still have a place in the market, but they're under pressure as well.
The Camaro, but the Camaros, we saw the new facelift. You and I were talking about that. I mean, and the stuff you got to do to keep them fresh.
Mm-hmm.
And then we saw Ford with the GT350 and the Bullitt Mustang and their new exhaust system as well. You're talking about technology, the way Camaro and Mustang seem to have the similar idea, you know, that ride quiet all the way to... Someone said, oh, that's new technology. I'm like, no, back in the 60s, it was called a dump valve. I mean, that's all you did was dump it, right? It's like it's just technical now. But
it is technical now. But, yeah, both of those cars are continuing to do that, and they're continuing to fight for share and fight for sales volume. But, again, you know, these are our cars, too, that because I do provide a halo, because they provide some excitement for the brand. You have to be really careful about how you manage the content in the vehicles.
I would think for Ford, you want to wait as long as possible with the GT500. I mean, you
build it up a little bit.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, you've got the 350 that people really haven't seen. You got the Bullet Mustang, right, which is going to be small quantities. But to build that up to that point, and then if you're Chevrolet, once you roll out that mid-engine Corvette, once you unveil it, mm-hmm, I don't think they're going to unveil it here.
Here in Detroit?
That feels like
we'll
a Geneva
see.
Car to me.
No.
You don't think so?
No. I don't think so. And that's instinctive more than anything else. But Geneva is an interesting environment because there's a lot of coach-built sports cars.
The Conan Sags and things like that that you see out there. Yeah, yeah.
But Chevrolet is not strong in Europe.
But that would be the car to make them talk. Ooh, and Corvettes are beloved when they go to Le Mans. I mean, you know, they always talk about, like, you see it, the reaction to it.
My expectation with that would be that would not be where the international reveal would be, but it would be on the stand in Geneva.
So would they just do it? You get the feeling, last question, Stephanie Brindley, you're so great with the time here. Senior analyst, IHS Market. Are we getting away from, like, the big cars don't have to, nobody wants to wait for an auto show anymore?
That's a loaded question, right? Auto shows are changing. And the reason is partly that there are a lot of platforms and a lot of places to introduce vehicles. And vehicles don't anymore go on sale in spring or fall. They're kind of launched all the way throughout the year.
Sure. It used to be like, European Asian cars, the best time to buy them was March.
Right.
And then, like,
right,
America, it was the fall.
Yep.
But that world doesn't apply
anymore.
It doesn't.
They roll out across. I don't know for sure if Chevrolet will be at the Detroit show next year. But, you know, Corvette is history, right?
Yeah.
It would be an interesting break if they didn't show it first in Detroit some way, somehow, whether it was in an auto show or at an event. But they haven't told me yet what their plan is.
I could see them unveiling it at Le Mans.
That would be interesting.
You want to go bust your foot off in Ford's butt because, mm-hmm, they've been killing you over there for the past couple of years, mm-hmm, with the cars that they cheated about. Anyway, yeah, funny how those cars all of a sudden got 2 seconds faster.
A little bit.
Yeah, it's amazing. Did you guys sandbag? No, it just happened that way.
Just worked out.
Well, where was the Ford GT unveiled?
That was Detroit. Oh, that was absolutely Detroit. Yes.
Okay. I'm having short-term memory loss here. I don't remember.
It was the same day as the Acura NSX.
I got to drive the NSX, though. I did get to drive that.
I've driven it briefly. That's a sweet thing, too.
Yeah. Anytime nice. Ken Langenfelter has a car in his collection, you know it's a cool car.
Right.
You know, although the folks at Ford, would you get the guy a GT, please? So what else is coming up? Is there anything that we should know about coming down the line that you've heard about or any vehicles? I mean, for me, I'm so intrigued with the Bronco and locally here. I mean, American brands.
Right.
Who knows when the Blazer. I want to see the finished Ranger when it comes out.
What they showed in Detroit is pretty much finished. That's what we're going to see for Ranger. I don't expect much difference between that and the production vehicle. Bronco is certainly highly anticipated. And I think it's more anticipated than the volume is going to show, right?
Okay.
You know, Wrangler is 280,000, 290,000 units a year, give or take. And Bronco probably won't do that. Like, you know, we are still talking about something that compared to the market is going to be relatively small. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see the new Lincoln Aviator. That's one that I'm curious to see. I want to drive the Cadillac XT4 when we get that. That was also unveiled in New York, but I want to see it on the road and within traffic on the show.
I'm going to bring it up again because last time we were here, and it still makes me insane, I cannot stand Cadillac's naming of their vehicles.
I know.
They have these amazing names.
Right.
That are cool sounding.
Yeah.
And some guy's like, you know, well, you want to refreshen it up. I mean, you mean like, Air Jordans, because God knows nobody buys those anymore, and he hasn't played basketball in 15 years. If it's a great name, it's a great name.
They don't translate always very well, and it is easier on a global landscape to do those names. Those names are confusing. I don't disagree with that at all.
Right.
The Cadillac system seems to be flowing a little bit better than the Lincoln MK system was.
Yeah, that was pretty bad.
Just, you know, you couldn't get your head around that one. And Lincoln has abandoned that, and they are going over time back to names. The concept for their new three-row will be a Lincoln Aviator.
It's beautiful.
It is a beautiful concept.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to seeing the production version of that, which also will be the same platform that Ford uses for Explorer, and it will be rear and all-wheel drive instead of front and all-wheel drive.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Why that? wonder.
Packaging and the way that they can do the exterior shape or proportions of the vehicle, you've got a much different, much sleeker look with that. And they decided to go that route with it.
I wish I could say I'd seen the new Explorer, but I can't because that was the part we couldn't talk about.
I have. I've Explorer?
Yeah.
Huh?
I don't know what you're talking
about.
Is
there a new one of those?
Yeah, no, that's the one.
Is that coming?
God, I hope so. Or they lied to us. And then Jeep, as far as everything there, I mean, there's nothing really
new
coming
up. We've got a pickup.
We got the pickup. When the hell? We've been talking about this for 4 years now.
Yeah, it takes time, doesn't it? Next year.
Next year?
Is what I'm expecting for that. And that'll be an interesting play in the midsize market because it's such an, we were talking about Jeep's image. That's going to be a lifestyle image pickup, maybe off-road lifestyle, but that's going to be a lifestyle image pickup where I believe that's what I expect out of it, where Chevrolet Colorado and Canyon and the Ford Ranger and all of those are also work trucks.
Honest last question. The price point for the Ram 1500, we're all hearing that it's higher for the new Ram coming out.
Right.
We're talking, what, $5,000 to $7,000 higher on average?
I think it's on average, but there's so much different content in there. It's a difficult one to pull through.
There was a time, though, that the Ram truck was perceived, and not in a bad way, but it was the work truck. It was the one that I don't want to spend $50,000 on a truck. I don't want to spend $40,000 on a Silverado. I'll get a Ram truck.
But, yeah, there's and that truck still exists. But there's opportunity to capture at the top end and certainly automakers are going to go for it. And the other thing that Ram has is that the prior generation 1500 is going to be around for another 12 months or so.
Right.
So they'll have the ability to help people walk from.
So kind of buffer it into that one.
Yeah.
It is beautiful though. That is a beautiful truck.
A ton more technology in there. I mean, think about the e-torque system, the mild hybrid system that I talked about is standard on the V6 engines. And optional on the V8 engines, and that'll give you a pretty significant fuel economy boost. They haven't clarified exactly what, but that costs money.
And the Tesla-sized monitor in there?
Yeah, the massive monitor. It's massive. And it looks great.
It does. It proportionally, it seems to work in there.
It seems to work okay in there, proportionally, I would agree. I was on the long lead for that vehicle and had a little bit of time with both a Ram with and without that screen. And as neat as that screen is, having them back to back, I wasn't quite sure it really did something more than the way that they have the layout of the buttons and the smaller screen did.
Oh.
I was like, okay, well, it's cool. It's techie looking, but I don't know that it was really more functional. One of the interesting things I thought was when you make that 12-inch screen, you make the navigation take over the whole screen. You end up with a lot of space that you don't necessarily need in terms of the map that's there. If you're scrolling,
no, whatever, I know what you're talking about. Because anyone who's ever had an iPad, like the HQ game, the most popular trivia game in the world, does not frame out on an iPad. It still centers on the middle because it's built for an iPhone.
It does fully frame out. It's fully.
It's
in
on there.
It's full view. But how much where you're the vehicle is still centered in that screen. And so on that screen, you've got 6 inches above that are showing you where you're headed, depending on how you've got your navigation set, and 6 inches below where you've been. And that's just more information than you actually need. And it's one of the reasons that portrait, that landscape navigation systems like the Alpha don't work as well, because you've got 3 inches on the side and 3 inches on the other side, which is information that you don't necessarily need.
Yeah.
And you don't necessarily have the information in front, which the direction you're going, which is what you really do need. So I thought it was interesting. I'm sure, you know, people are going to gravitate toward that screen because of the cool factor. I'm not sure that it truly makes the living with the experience better. It doesn't make it worse. It was pretty intuitive and pretty functional, but I don't know that makes it better.
Now we're guys. It's all about size.
Yeah. And it is a truck.
The shallow end of the pool. So, all right, Stephanie, thanks so much for coming in. Senior analyst, IHS Markets. Always fun talking with you.
Oh, it's always fun. Thanks for having me back.
My next review I'm actually driving right now, the Genesis G90.
Nice.
It's the first car in a long time I've driven that I want someone else to drive me around. I sat in the back seat and went, what the hell?
Yeah.
Is that a Korean chauffeur car? I mean,
it is.
Yeah, it's a wonderful car to drive, but you're like, I want to sit back there.
I was in the back.
Yeah.
Yeah, that and the Lincoln Continental, both of those.
Same thing, right?
Drive me around.
Just get Joe. He'll take care of you. Okay. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.